continue the siege of a major hospital in southern Gaza, turning it into a military base and arresting a large number of medical staff. A rights advocacy group says Israel is committing the crime of enforced disappearance against Palestinian citizens kidnapped from Gaza. And the head of the UN Agency for Palestinian Refugees says Israel is waging a concerted campaign to destroy UNRWA. Thank you for joining us. Today's top story, Israeli forces have carried out arrests at Nasser Hospital, Gaza's largest functioning hospital, as airstrikes hit across the besieged territory. Gaza's health officials say regime forces detained a large number of medical staff inside the hospital. They said Israeli forces turned the hospital into a military base. Regime forces raided the facilities on Thursday after laying siege on it for weeks. Meantime, the Israeli occupation has committed 9 more massacres against families in the Gaza Strip. It has killed 83 people and wounded 125 others during the past 24 hours. At least 10 civilians, including women and children, were killed by Israeli airstrikes hitting a residential building in central Gaza and a farmland in the south of the Strip. Nearly 29,000 Palestinians have been killed and about 1.5 million displaced in the Israeli genocide in Gaza since October the 7th. Now to talk more on this, we are joined by Mr. Paul Foote, academic and commentator from Irvine, California. Mr. Foote, welcome to Press TV. Now, Mr. Foote, the Israeli army has besieged the facility for weeks, trapping thousands of patients, medical staff, and displaced families inside the hospital. And now Israeli soldiers arrested a large number of workers at the besieged facility. Mr. Foote, the question is, why the medical staff? I mean, they are performing their professional humanitarian duty in treating the wounded and the sick. The Palestinian NGO urges the international community to take swift action to stop the alarming rate of enforced disappearance of Palestinians from the Gaza Strip. The Palestinian Prisoner Society said despite the global outcry, Tel Aviv refrains from disclosing any information about the fate of the kidnapped Palestinians. The organization also expressed concern about reports of executions and torture by Israeli soldiers. The NGO urged the international community to take swift action to stop such crimes. Last week, Geneva-based human rights group Euromed published a bombshell report. It said Israel brings groups of settlers to prisons to witness the torture of the abductees from Gaza. The Geneva-based group says the regime even allows the settlers to film the abductees as they are stripped naked and beaten with metal batons and electric sticks. The group had condemned such acts of brutality as a war crime and crime against humanity, warning that it will fuel hatred and extremism. Israeli forces have clashed with protesters in Tel Aviv during a large-scale demonstration against the regime's political failures. Thousands of Israelis gathered outside the Ministry of Military Affairs and Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu's residence. Israeli forces beat numerous demonstrators and detained some. Protesters demanded the release of Israeli captives held by Palestinian resistance groups. The premier has been under fire for prioritizing his political interests in Gaza over the lives of the captives. Netanyahu has been in hot water as he is embroiled in a number of scandals. The Israeli premier is charged with fraud and breach of trust. This has prompted protesters to take to the streets almost every weekend to call for his immediate resignation. The head of the UN Agency for Palestinian Refugees, Felipe Lazzarini, says Israel is waging a concerted campaign aimed at dismantling UNRWA. Lazzarini said the regime believes that if the UN agency is abolished, the status of the Palestinian refugees will be resolved once and for all, and with it, the right of return. He said this has been a long-term political goal of Tel Aviv. He cited various Israeli actions as evidence, including revoking UNRWA's VAT exemptions, restricting food deliveries through Ashdod Port, and targeting over 150 UNRWA facilities since October the 7th. Israel has called for Lazzarini to step down following claims that a Hamas tunnel had been discovered under its evacuated Gaza City headquarters. Lazzarini said the tunnel was 20 meters below ground and UNRWA, as a humanitarian organization, did not have the capabilities to examine what was underground in Gaza. Earlier, we were joined by former president of Guyana, Donald Ramotor, for an exclusive interview on the Israeli genocide in Gaza. He said UNRWA funding cuts by the US and its allies are aimed at appeasing Israel and are a response to the ICJ ruling. Let's take a listen.
Well, the first instance is, I would say that this is part of a legacy of colonialism in the area, in which Palestinian people were given no choice, they were given no options, they were given nothing at all. When this Israel was imposed on the Palestinian state. And the problem actually started from then, because without consultation, people moving into your territory, and then what happened in 1948, which is called the Nakba, is compounding the problem, and that problem has not been resolved up to this point in time. The Palestinian people have been, in my view, the people who have been subjected to the worst type of oppression, national oppression, for more than 75 years since the occupation, since the accession of Israel came into existence. But what is taking place here today is definitely a genocide, probably comparable with the worst atrocities of Hitlerite fascism in the Second World War. The unfortunate thing is that many of the countries who were the colonial masters, the countries that support this actions, are the very countries that colonialized the world, and the United States, which has become the new imperialist. I think that this, what they did with the UN agency there, was a response, in my view, to the ruling of the court, in order to satisfy Israel that they're on their side. And this was a direct attack on it, because these are mere accusations without any investigation beginning. These people are dismissed, and they immediately withheld whatever funding that they have been giving to the UN UNRWA body, giving it to them. They have withdrawn and withheld a lot of money, and that makes them complicit with the genocide and the starvation that is taking place in the Gaza Strip right now.
The US-dominated bloc of G7 has voiced its concern over the risk of forcible displacement of Palestinians out of Gaza and the consequences of an onslaught against Rafah region. A statement by the bloc said G7 foreign ministers call for urgent action to address the catastrophic humanitarian crisis in Gaza. They also expressed deep concern for the potentially devastating consequences of Israel's full-scale attack on the Rafah region. The U.S. and some of its allies have in recent days voiced concern over the staggering civilian casualties in Gaza and the regime's plans to attack Rafah. However, the U.S. has stopped short of taking any action to discourage the regime from killing more Palestinians and even moved to send more weapons to Gaza. The U.S. has been providing the regime with advanced weapons and munitions throughout the onslaught. Washington has also vetoed two UN Security Council resolutions that call on the regime to end this aggression. That's while hundreds of thousands of pro-Palestinian protesters have again marched through central London, calling on the British government to push for a ceasefire in Gaza and to stop its military and political support for the apartheid Israeli regime. As Saipul Rezal reports, British political parties' position on the Gaza genocide has become a centrepiece of elections taking place in the UK this year.
Anger in the streets of London. Another mass protest. A turnout of hundreds of thousands. Veteran campaigners, young activists, British Jewish groups.
It's the fourth national demonstration of the year and the second one to end outside the Israeli embassy here in London. And their message, these protesters say, is clear. Stop the genocide now.
That's what they have been demanding for more than 4 months now. And the impending Israeli incursion into the southern Gaza city of Rafah, that shelters more than 1.5 million Palestinians, accounts for today's turnout. One of the largest since it all began. A free Palestine is yet to come, but there is a chance for British politicians to stop the ongoing mass slaughter. On February 21st, MPs, representatives of the British public, will be voting on a second ceasefire motion. The first such vote, November last year, didn't pass muster. We asked Ben Jamal of the Palestine Solidarity Campaign what message a no vote would send to the Palestinians.
It will deliver a message to the Palestinian people that the British Parliament says your lives don't matter. The message we've delivered today is that they do matter to the British people. And that now the British Parliament needs to start listening to what the British people are saying.
The political party's position on Israel's genocidal war on Gaza has taken center stage in this year's upcoming general elections in the UK. And the protesters here say it determines which way their vote will go. Saeed Purza, London.
Now, thousands of supporters of Pakistan's former Prime Minister Imran Khan have taken to the streets nationwide to condemn what they perceive as fraud and manipulation in the recent general elections. This comes in light of admissions by certain election officials acknowledging their involvement in the alleged vote rigging. Our correspondent Nasser Kazmi reports from the Pakistani capital, Islamabad.
Supporters of the jailed Pakistani former Premier Imran Khan and his party, Pakistan Tehreek-e-Insaf or PTI, held nationwide protests on Saturday to condemn alleged manipulation in the February 8 general election.
The mandate that the people of Pakistan has given the independent, so-called independent candidates, backed by none other than PTI, because our election symbol was taken away, our entire leadership is behind jails with sham, aapke jo mukadmaat hai. So this doesn't make any sense. When the people have spoken, they have to be respected. Otherwise, they will be on the street, it will be chaos, and no government, no political party will be able to rule.
Supporters of Imran Khan's party insist that widespread electoral manipulation has deprived their party of achieving two-thirds majority in the parliament. However, Imran Khan's rival political group, Pakistan Muslim League Nawaz, says the PTI party tried to derail democracy by creating controversy around elections. A dramatic change in the political climate occurred when the commissioner of Rawalpindi, a city in northern Pakistan, tendered his resignation, citing a guilty conscience for his role in enabling widespread electoral manipulation in the garrison city.
We converted the losers into winners with 70,000 votes margin. The chief election commissioner and chief justice are involved in poll fraud. I accept all the responsibility. I should be hanged. I cannot participate in the crime that could destroy Pakistan.
This is while Pakistan's election commission has rejected claims made by the Rawalpindi commissioner, stating that no official of the electoral body gave any direction to him regarding the manipulation of results.
The outcry over alleged vote rigging in the recently held elections for national and state legislatures has sparked widespread protests among multiple political factions. Analysts warn that the absence of a clear mandate for any political party could lead to prolonged political instability and hinder efforts to address economic challenges of the country. Nasser Kazmi, Islamabad.
And the Iran has unveiled fully homegrown defensive weaponry. The military hardware includes an anti-ballistic missile system as well as a low-altitude air defense system. Gisumi Shahmadi reports from Tehran.
Guarding the homeland against the threats from above, Iran's defense ministry has unveiled advanced air defense systems, further strengthening its position as one of the few countries that have acquired the technology involved in the detection, tracking, interception, and destruction of attacking missiles, both long-range and short-range.
Today, we are witnessing major achievements that have significantly increased our defense capabilities. The Arman anti-ballistic missile defense system is named after martyr Arman Ali Verdi. It is classified as a tactical air defense system, Arman is equipped with a domestically made Syed-3 class, and it is capable of simultaneously detecting and tracking 24 targets at a distance ranging from 120 to 180 kilometers.
This new cutting-edge defensive weapon is also equipped with a self-protection system that makes it immune to potential low-altitude threats. The Arman defense system's radars and missile launchers have been incorporated into a single vehicle to enhance agility in defensive operations, allowing it to engage in operation in less than 3 minutes.
Azarakhsh, the other system we are unveiling today, is a low-altitude defense system. It's considered a versatile defense weapon that can be installed on different types of vehicles. This adds to its mobility and makes it ideal for agile responses. Therefore, it can be used to provide security for protected areas.
The state-of-the-art technology applied in both of the newly unveiled military hardware enhances defensive posture and boosts deterrence to adversary aggression, significantly increasing Iran's air defense capabilities once they are added to the country's military fleet. Iran has made remarkable breakthroughs in manufacturing a broad range of homegrown military hardware in line with the policy to strengthen its defense capabilities, a red line that will never be up for any kind of negotiation. Iran has come a long way over the past 45 years in its defense capabilities, becoming fully self-sufficient, turning from a country that had to import the military hardware that it needed to one that today is producing all the military equipment that it needs and also developing new ones. Gisum Shahmadi, Tehran.
With that, we come to the end of this bulletin. Thank you for listening. Take care and bye-bye for now.
This is IRIB English Radio. With you early in the morning. With you at midday. With you till the night's end. IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight.
Pro-Palestinian activists have complained of suppression of speech since the Zionist regime's war on Gaza began on October 7th. In this regard, we have taken a look at world media websites and news agencies for further details. Stay tuned for more. Middle East Eye wrote, a prominent pro-Palestinian advocacy group in New York City, Within Our Lifetime, or WOL, had its main Instagram page, backup accounts, and founders account shut down recently. WOL wrote on X, as Zionist forces continued their crackdown on Palestine online and in the streets, Instagram has permanently deleted both WOL and WOL chair Nerdin Keswani's main and backup accounts with no option to appeal or request a review to restore them. But the more they try to silence us, the louder we will be. According to the New York Jewish Week, a spokesperson for Meta told them that the accounts had been removed because they violated the platform's community guidelines, including its dangerous organizations and individuals policy. Keswani received a message from Meta saying that her accounts were removed because your account or activity on it doesn't follow our community guidelines. Middle East Eye reached out to Meta for comment but did not receive a response by the time of the publication of this article. Abdullah Akel, an activist with WOL, told Middle East Eye, Meta is telling us that we are banned from their platform because we as individuals, we as an organization, are going against their policies. It makes it very clear that if we are standing against this genocide and we aren't allowed on this platform, that Instagram has taken a side. We will continue what we are doing. We will make it clear to the world that we will not be silenced. We will only be louder. A December 2023 report from Human Rights Watch, HRW, said that Meta, which runs Instagram and Facebook, is systematically censoring content about Palestine on their social networks. The 51-page report, Meta's Broken Promises, Systematic Censorship of Palestine Content on Instagram and Facebook, released recently by HRW, documents a pattern of undue removal and suppression of protected speech, including peaceful expression in support of Palestine and public debate about Palestinian human rights. Deborah Brown, acting Associate Technology and Human Rights Director at HRW, said, Meta censorship of content in support of Palestine adds insult to injury at a time of unspeakable atrocities and repression already stifling Palestinian expression. Brown added, social media is an essential platform for people to bear witness and speak out against abuses, while Meta censorship is furthering the erasure of Palestinian suffering. When Meta was accused of suppressing pro-Palestinian speech last year, Meta blamed technical bugs, claiming this bug affected accounts equally around the globe and had nothing to do with the subject matter of the content, and we fixed it as quickly as possible. But the Hampton Institute think tank accused Instagram and Facebook of actively blocking posts about the factual history of Israel and Palestine. Middle East Eye at the time asked Meta that steps were being taken to ensure access to Palestine-related content and whether the company was suppressing pro-Palestinian content, what was referred to a 13 October newsroom post. The statement said that Meta's policies are applied equally and that there is no truth to the suggestion that they are deliberately suppressing the voice. Both Keswani's and WOL's Instagram accounts have been removed in the past, but were always brought back. It is unclear if the removal of the account is permanent this time around. For the past few weeks, WOL has been organizing protests and rallies across New York City to spread awareness of the Zionist regime's crimes against Palestinians. The activists are not afraid to call out politicians by name and often bring speakers who are directly affected by the war in Gaza. These efforts highlighted after the October 7th, when the Zionist regime's war in Gaza broke out, when multiple protests were being organized every week, many of them organized within a day. The WOL Instagram page was an important way for the organization to let people know about upcoming protests and demonstrations against the fabricated regime of Israel. Recently, activists held an emergency rally in Manhattan outside News Corp and eventually marched through a tunnel shouting for a free Palestine.
Food for thought.
Hello everyone, let us enlighten our minds and souls with an admonishment from the Holy Prophet's fourth infallible heir, Imam Zainul Abidin or Imam Sajjad, peace be upon him. O son of Adam, you are under right as long as you are admonished by your own self. Care very much for maintaining judgment with yourself, and betake fear as your slogan and caution as your garment. O son of Adam, you will unquestionably be dead, resurrected and standing before your Lord the Majestic. You should prepare an answer for all that.
Iranian Radio, Global Mission. This is IRIB English Radio.
This is A to Z. An introduction to Islamic lifestyle. Today's lesson, the significance of the Islamic Revolution of Iran. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Welcome to A to Z show. Dear listeners, this is Ali, and in today's episode of A to Z, we want to talk about the Islamic Revolution of Iran and the founder of the Islamic Revolution of Iran, namely Imam Khomeini. Imam Khomeini, Ridwanullah Ta'ala Alayh, was a distinguished personality even within the world of Islam, let alone the entire world, right? He was special. He had principled stances that he took on different issues, and those stances attracted people towards Imam and his ideology. Now, when we say the path of Imam Khomeini or the ideology of Imam Khomeini, we want to look into where does he get his ideology from? What's his source? So, brothers and sisters, once we study the traditions of Prophet and Ahlul Bayt and what they have said and done in their lifetime, their seerah and, you know, their sayings, if we combine it all, we will see that Imam Khomeini's ideology traces back to the ideology of the Prophet and Imams. This is the source. And again, if you open up the Holy Quran, the divine word of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, and if you look at those principles that are written in that divine book, you will see that Imam Khomeini's principles are based on those very principles. So in a nutshell, the ideology of Imam Khomeini is based on Quran, the Prophet, and the Imams, which is the Ahlul Bayt. Now, in order for us to be able to understand what the Islamic Revolution of Iran was all about, we need to be able to understand what Imam Khomeini stood for. What are his principles? What are those principles that he extracted from Quran and from the sayings and lives of Ahlul Bayt? Today we are talking about Imam Khomeini's stance regarding America. Brothers and sisters, as we said earlier, America is behind all that's gone wrong. This is the stance of Imam Khomeini. Imam Khomeini also called America to be the Great Satan. And if you look at the slogan of Death to America, today an ever-increasing number of nations cry out loud, Death to America. Of course, it is clear that this slogan does not mean death to the American nation, but death to American policies, death to arrogance, as explained by the leader of the Islamic Revolution, Imam Sayyid Ali Khamenei. He has explicitly mentioned it, that it is not about, this slogan is not about those who are themselves oppressed, an average American public. No, it is only for those who support that evil system one way or the other, and for the system itself. So death to America today, if you look at the Arabic language, it is translated as Al-Mautul Amrika. If you look at Farsi language, it is called Marg Bar Amrika. And if you look at Urdu language, it is called Murdabad Amrika.
Welcome back to your listeners.
So we're talking about this divine slogan where the reality of America is being challenged. This system of arrogance is being challenged. Today, the flag of revolution, awakening, and guidance of the Muslim Ummah is being carried by Imam Khamenei. Under his leadership, nations have not only recognized their friends and foes, but are also treading on the path of dignity, the path of honor, and the path of self-respect. Today, the oppressed nations around the globe refuse to bow down before the hegemonic and bullying policies of the United States of America, the hub of Zionism, the mother of Zionism. These fruits of the Islamic Revolution can be realized when one inspects the Islamic movement of Nigeria. You have seen what has happened to Sheikh Zakzaki. When we look at Yemen, look at the oppression being done at Yemen, right? For standing up to the arrogant policies of the front of arrogance, right? That is composed and comprised of America, Britain, Israel, Saudi Arabia, UAE, all of these culprits, they got together. For what? To oppress the general public around the globe. Look at Yemen, look at Nigeria, look at Palestine, look at Lebanon, Pakistan, and Iraq. Brothers and sisters, it is evident that the bloc of Islamic resistance is getting stronger day by day, from Iran to Iraq to Syria to Lebanon. And this is thorn in the eye of the enemy of humanity. And this is what we need to know. This Death to America slogan sums it all up. Thank you.
IRIB English Radio. Our website is parstoday.ir.
You can email us at englishradio@irib.ir.
It must be heaven.
Part 3.
The 60s was a decade of the great rebellion of European filmmakers against Hollywood. Jean-Luc Godard, as the most famous filmmaker of the New Wave in France, was at the forefront of all the rebellions that targeted the capitalist system and the Hollywood studio system. In 1968, Godard, the most revolutionary anti-Hollywood filmmaker, went to Jordan. He visited the Palestinian camps, met Abu Ali, Hani, Johariya, and their friends, and filmed the refugee camps and guerrilla bases. He used the videos in a movie titled Here and Elsewhere. In the same year, the U.S. proposed a peace plan to the conflicting parties in the Middle East. The Palestinians objected and started a demonstration on the streets of Jordan. The experience of accompanying Palestinians with great revolutionary directors had awakened the dormant dreams of Abu Ali and his friends. When the photography department team, whose main members were Mustafa Abu Ali, Hani, Johariya, and Mersal, watched the recorded images of the demonstrations, they came to the conclusion that they have everything they needed to make a movie. So they started working and made a 20-minute movie called Say No to the Peace Plan. It was the first movie of resistance organizations. The movie was screened to senior leaders of Fatah. The Palestinian leaders found something in the movie that became the main reason for their interest in cinema: the power of cinema in explaining the situation in the battlefield. The Revolution Cinema was the title Fatah leaders chose for the Palestinian cinema. Mustafa Abu Ali, in a statement, wrote for Palestine Film Foundation and highlighted the goals of the revolutionary cinema as follows. The sound of guns should be louder than any other sound. Light weapons are the people's main weapons in the war, and in the same way, light 16mm cameras are the most suitable weapon for the cinema about people. The success of a movie should be measured by the same criteria as the success of a military operation. They are both seeking to realize a political ideal.
We create a new people, and instead of being refugees, to be fighters. This is very important. We were refugees, homeless. We became now fighters, freedom fighters.
In the first step, the Palestinian cinema changed a stereotypical image of the Palestinian people. Now, after 20 years, the motivated pictures of the cinematographers replaced the image of the oppressed Palestinian refugees with that of fighting warriors. The Israelis could not put up with the Palestinians, who were now united to liberate their land. Soon enough, the conflict between Fatah and Israel began. Fatah guerrillas were the most important targets of Israel in its attacks on the Karameh village in Jordan.
Okay.
After Israel's rapid retreat, the battle became a legendary victory for the Palestinians, whose value doubled after the heavy defeat by the Arabs in the Six-Day War. Only in the first 48 hours after the end of the war, 5,000 Palestinians applied for membership in the organization. The Battle of Karameh initially brought about the unity of the Kingdom of Jordan and the Palestinians. But soon, the gaining of power by Fatah's guerrillas led to internal differences, and that got out of control and led to a widespread and bloody conflict. King Hussein of Jordan was targeted in an assassination attempt. The Jordanian army blamed the Palestinians. In September of 1970, King Hussein attacked the guerrillas' positions and pushed them back to the Syrian borders. Although the Fatah organization inevitably set up its organization once again in the south of Lebanon, the eventful years after exile left a deep impact on Palestinian society. Defeated by Israel and the West, disillusionment with the Arabs, the bad conditions of the refugees and displacement and isolation in Arab societies strengthened the unity of the people who were suffering from similar mental injuries. A narrative based on a common pain could act as a unifying factor. A great task was assigned to the Palestinian cinema, introducing the Palestinian national narrative instead of the failed idea of a united Arab nation. Making more than 60 documentary films was an answer to the need. It seems in these movies, all places are the same, and it's a collective situation for Palestinians. The soothing images of trees and orchards, even if they're just inside the refugee camps, they will suddenly be bombarded. The scenes of destruction and death after strikes are eventually replaced with the epic views of weapons, military training, and battle. The goal of recreating the battle scenes in these documentaries is to show a good ending to get rid of the pain of failure. By different means, the documentaries emphasize the correction of the past is made possible by referring to children or by depicting them. They are the manifestation of the future and hope against despair and disappointment of the past. In many scenes, the images of children are merged with the images of soldiers, followed by epic images of the Palestinian flag. These are the common symbols that continuously appear in Palestinian cinema and literature. They are the embodiments of hope, resurrection, and struggle. At first glance, this structure describes specific events, but since these stereotypes are repeated over and over in the form of similar scenes, it becomes something more than the recurring stereotypes. The most important achievement of the repetitive structure is the creation of a shared historical memory. The memory paints a unified picture of the Palestinian nation. As a result, geographically and socially, the divided community of refugees is united around a single memory. The memory of the United Palestinian Nation.
Life is full of choices. Choose the best option. Visit us at parstoday.ir/en. IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight.
White House has called on Congress to pass security bill with military aid for the Zionist regime, as experts say Washington is tethered to Israel's war effort. In this regard, we have taken a look at world media websites and news agencies for further details. Stay tuned for more. Middle East Eye wrote, U.S. President Joe Biden urged the House of Representatives to pass a $95 billion national security funding bill that includes billions in military aid to Israel, underlying the U.S. administration's continued belief in unconditional military backing for the Zionist regime, despite tensions over a looming invasion of Rafah in Gaza. Hours after the Senate finally approved security funding for Ukraine, Taiwan, and Israel, recently Biden challenged the House of Representatives to move on this with urgency. The bulk of the bill provides $60 billion in military aid to Ukraine, whose stock of ammunition supplies is rapidly dwindling. But it also sets aside $14 billion in aid to Israel, which Biden, in a statement, claimed will provide Israel with what it needs to protect its people. The bill would provide an additional $10.6 billion in military assistance to the Zionist regime, in addition to the $3.5 billion in foreign military financing it regularly receives, while it earmarks $1.6 billion in humanitarian assistance for Palestinians in Gaza. It specifically prohibits funds from going to the UN Agency for Palestinian Relief, UNRWA. In response to the Zionist regime's allegations that members of the agency have ties to the resistance group Hamas, the bill passed the Senate by a vote of 70 to 29. Three Democrats, Bernie Sanders, Jeff Merkley, and Peter Welch, voted no in response to the Zionist regime's conduct in Gaza. But resistance to the bill came mainly from Republican lawmakers who opposed it, with the backing of former President Donald Trump amid a spat with Democrats over immigration. The bill is unlikely to become law anytime soon. because Republican Speaker of the House Mike Johnson has indicated he will not allow it to come to vote in the lower chamber in response to Trump's plea. Biden's statement recently urging the House to pass the bill included just two lines on the Zionist regime. Despite publicly rebuking Israel for what the U.S. president labeled as an over-the-top military response to the October 7th events, which sparked the war, his administration has shown no willingness to cut its military funding. The bill's passage in the Senate comes at a critical juncture in the war. Recently, CIA Director Bill Burns met Israeli regime Mossad chief David Bernia, Egyptian intelligence chief Abbas Kamel, and Qatari Prime Minister Sheikh Mohammed bin Abdurrahman Al Thani in Cairo, according to the Wall Street Journal. Burns, the Biden administration's top troubleshooter in pushing for a prisoner exchange between the resistance movement Hamas and the child killer regime of Israel that would pause the fighting in Gaza and create a space for what the administration hopes will be a permanent ceasefire, former U.S. officials told Middle East Eye previously. At the same time, thousands of Palestinians already displaced by the war are streaming out of Rafah amid fears of a looming Zionist regime's invasion of the border city, whose population has swelled to 1.4 million, with people seeking refuge from the Zionist regime's bombardment. Recently, UN humanitarian chief Martin Griffiths warned the Zionist regime's planned military push into the southern city could lead to a slaughter of Palestinians. But an Israeli regime assault would also reverberate outside the besieged enclave, with experts telling MEE that Palestinians may flock to Egypt's Sinai Peninsula to escape the offensive, a development that could spark a political firestorm in Cairo, a key U.S. ally and Zionist regime's peace partner. The Biden administration is unlikely to risk a full-blown rift with the Zionist regime over Rafah because it wants its cooperation to strike a hostage deal. Aaron David Miller, a former U.S. West Asia negotiator, now at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace, told MEE, they, the Biden administration, are so tethered to the Israeli war that creating an open breach with Netanyahu will leave them with no policy, Miller said, adding, Rafah is not the fulcrum from which U.S. policy on Israel and Hamas is going to be waged. They want a hostage deal. You can hang a close for the season sign if the U.S. doesn't get that done. The looming Zionist regime's assault comes as some of Washington's closest Western allies have started to criticize its military aid to the Zionist regime. Recently, European Union Foreign Policy Chief Josep Borrell asked why the United States was continuing to provide arms to the child killer regime of Israel if you believe that too many people are being killed. The bill's passage in the Senate also underscored how criticism of Israel has taken a backseat to U.S. lawmakers' concerns over Ukraine and Taiwan. U.S. Senator Chris Van Hollen, one of the Zionist regime's harshest critics in the Senate, voted for the bill the same day he accused it of conducting a textbook war crime in Gaza.
Gaza Under Attack. Welcome back to Gaza Under Attack, coming to you from the British capital, London. I'm Saeed Pourreza. We'll get you my panel of guests in just a moment, but before that, a quick recap of some of the latest developments. A pressure cooker of despair. That's how the UN described the southern Gaza city of Rafah, where more than 1.5 million Palestinians are sheltering and are now forced to flee again ahead of a possible Israeli ground offensive. Also, another escalation. At least one Israeli soldier has been killed and 8 others injured after rockets were fired from Lebanon into the city of Safad. It came after apartheid Israel said it bombed southern Lebanon overnight. And calls for banning the Israeli regime from all global sports competitions gain momentum. European Parliament member Claire Daly signs a petition calling on sports federations worldwide to suspend the apartheid regime until it complies with international law. So far, the U.S.-Israeli genocidal war on Gaza has killed at least 28,000 Palestinians and wounded some 69,000 others, with no sign of the massacre ending anytime soon. Joining me to talk about it all is Ammar Kazmi in the studio. Ammar is a legal and political analyst and worked in the parliamentary office of former Labour MP Chris Williamson. And joining him via Skype is Dr. Nahad Khanfar, a lecturer in law and politics. Gentlemen, welcome to you both. I'll start with you, Ammar. South Africa has launched an urgent request to the International Court of Justice over Israel's planned Rafah offensive. Explain what it might mean and if it has any greater chance of stopping the carnage from going ahead than the other ruling that came earlier.
Well, look, I was on an earlier program before discussing the ICJ, potential outcomes of the ICJ judgment, and I took a pretty cynical view, which was that I didn't think it was really going to amount to much. I didn't think it was going to have any material effect in stopping the genocide in Gaza. I think a few weeks now since that has happened, that has been proven to be true, because ultimately the enforcement powers of the ICJ are very limited. Ultimately, it is the job of the UN Security Council to enforce ICJ decisions and judgments. And we know that the United States of America is a permanent member of the UN Security Council and can veto anything that they decide to do. Now, of course, it's very important what South Africa is doing. It's continuing to raise the issue in terms of from a legal perspective. We've seen that as a consequence, some countries like the Netherlands have decided to stop the export of certain types of weapons
for F-35s.
And parts, spare parts to Israel. And it could be the case, and it does sometimes happen where the ICJ, after already making an order, could decide to take additional provisions and measures. But ultimately, again, it comes down to enforcement. So yes, it may potentially help to ramp up the pressure on some governments who are supporting Israel to desist from doing that. Yes. But in terms of literally intervening and stopping what's happening, I don't think that's what we're going to see as a result of
and
this.
And what it will probably also do is keep the Palestinian plight in the spotlight for the world to see. Dr. Khanfar, the Israeli Prime Minister Netanyahu and his war cabinet seem hell-bent on pushing forward with this plan to launch an incursion into Rafah, despite pleadings and outrage from sections of the international community. What could cause Israel to pause at this stage? Because Ammar believes that even if there is some kind of measure from the ICJ, it has to go to the UN Security Council, where the U.S. will veto it.
The Americans, the only people really can stop this, and they are the only partners they can impose serious pressure on Netanyahu. But it seems to be that Netanyahu trying all the time to preserve his position as a prime minister because he doesn't want to face consequences if this war just has an end. And it seems to be that the Americans still not really very much interested in calling for a ceasefire simply because they wanted to give Netanyahu any kind of of victory, like any picture of victory in any way or form. And it seems to be